Welcome back. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are talking with David Halberstam. When you talk about the entertainment economy, you're also talking about a whole phenomenon of celebrity and what you just described in terms of the signature people in the networks. The celebrity part, I go back to my crazy metaphor about music. In a symphony, you don't have only the guy out front. You have to have some other things happening as well. I was very struck in your newest book, The Children, that you have a sense that it takes a lot of people doing a lot of things over a fairly long time to begin to appreciate where we are. Doesn't this cult of celebrity get us in big trouble?
Well, most of the people who are held up as celebrities, as well as most of the people interviewing them on television, are, I think, remarkably inauthentic people. The other day I was in my gym working out and coming out, and there was this very familiar face that went by. This is up in New York at the Reebok gym. I thought, oh, goodness, I recognize him. I'm trying to think, is he a college classmate or whatever?
Do I know this
and
person?
And then it was, what was the name of the lawyer named Shapiro in the O.J. Simpson case? What was his first name again? Is it Mark or... What was his name?
I sat that one out.
For a couple months, he was the most famous guy in L.A., and he was on every night, and Barbara Walters and all those people were just as they're competing to be the new best friend of of William Ginsberg. They were competing to be his new best friend. And then, having danced through our homes and on the screen, he's gone, and we are not the better or the wiser. And, is he real? Did he do anything in this society that either affects us in any profound way? No. Whereas there are issues, whether it's affirmative action, take an issue like that, which is a huge, complicated issue. You've had referenda, I guess you'd probably say, in both Michigan and Texas, which have changed the way graduate placement is done. And suddenly there has been a dramatic fall off in black people and minorities in graduate schools,
also
particularly
in California,
law schools.
Yeah.
Tragic. Down to 1 or 2%, I believe, from 10 or 15. And now Michigan is embattled in a comparable legal action. You're really looking at something that could take us back to, given the needs and the drive and the expectations of this society, you take in 1990 and the new millennium time to a kind of process that's pre-Brown versus Board of Education from the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are potentially devastating consequences to this.
You sure wouldn't know it in the news.
That's not getting covered on most of these wonderful magazines. So you could almost begin to come up with a theorem that, in fact, the more famous a journalist is in the magazines and the more money he or she makes, the less real reporting they do and the less close they are to things that matter in the society, that they're being rewarded for doing things that are about ratings and titillation.
Mm-hmm. You talk about inauthentic, and you do it in a context in your latest book of people who, by your accounting and by recollection, are true heroes.
Mm-hmm.
in very important ways. Trying to make that separation. Our heroes today are sports heroes.
Michael Jordan, I really like Michael Jordan.
Well, I'm not picking on him. This is a question.
He's the best athlete I've ever seen in my lifetime. He's a really great basketball player. But he's not a hero to me. He's a great basketball player. That's a very big difference.
Well, and that's really what I want to ask. It's sports, but it's also military. If we happen to have a war, Desert Storm, we cranked out a couple of heroes. They sort of blessedly came and went fairly quickly.
Or celebrities.
How do you define it? And I might say a lot of your career has been sort of against the trend, starting with the best and the brightest,
mm-hmm.
who were self-appointed heroes. How do we distinguish? How do we find those people?
Well, for me, my categories might not necessarily fit other people. I like people who go against the grain of the society on acts of conscience and take considerable risk in the doing of this, often physical risks, at moments that matter. I mean, which is really what these young people that I've written about in the new book, who were the first sit-in kids and the Freedom Riders, who were the real infantrymen and the company commanders in the movement from that period in 1960 to 1965 in changing this country and ending the last vestiges of legal feudalism in the society. And, you know, most of that...
It's a really strong statement, legal feudalism.
Yeah, legal feudalism, yeah. Well, if you tell a certain percentage of the society, almost 50% in certain states, that they don't have the right to vote, I would call that legal feudalism. You know, the denial of franchise and dignity. You deny people the right to vote, you're denying them almost everything else. I think they're genuine heroes. Most of the writing about that time tends to center on Martin Luther King, and in no way to denigrate him, particularly as we're coming near the 30th anniversary of his murder, because I had covered him as well, and he was a legitimate great American with a great and compelling and eloquent voice and a brilliant staff around him who made, in a period of 10 years, a series of astonishingly shrewd and deft tactical moves in this same thing. That writing only about him is really writing about that period, like writing about World War II and only writing about Dwight Eisenhower and Winston Churchill. I mean, these were the young people who did it. Now, here in Atlanta, your congressman, John Lewis, who is, you know, you asked me one, had I met one hero in my lifetime, single out one person who is your hero from reporting, I'd say John Lewis of Pike County, Alabama. I mean, he used to say he was from Troy because he felt it.
It wasn't true. Pike County is farther out.
More rural. In fact, shows up at Fisk, and when he goes, joins the movement, one of my young friends who's in the book, Curtis Murphy, who himself is from rural West Tennessee, says, my God, that boy's even more country than I am. He talks like he's got a mouthful of manure. John, I mean, just unfailingly steadfast. I mean, a great citizen. And critical moments in this book are marked by two savage beatings that he absorbed. One in the spring of 1961 in the Montgomery bus depot when he's almost murdered by the Ku Klux Klan, and then 4 years later on the Pettus Bridge at Selma, where he's leading a march and mounted Alabama troopers come at them and whack them. All of this recorded by cameras and television and newsreel men. He's almost killed again, and that helps get the Voting Rights Act of 65. So,
well, and you comment that these things are not new things that were happening. It's just that nobody had seen them before.
Well, these young people that I write about were brilliant in that they lured the beast of segregation to the surface, and they did that very consciously, knowing that they were risking their lives. I mean, as you know, Bernard Lafayette, John Lewis, as they set out for Alabama that morning from Nashville, they made out wills. Can you believe this? I mean, this is what I tried to write about in the book. I think it's the best book I've ever written, and it's certainly getting the best reviews I've ever had. And that's a great. You know, I've had a great run. This book's on the bestseller list some places already, and that makes 10 in a row.
10 bestsellers in a row.
But I think this is the best book, and it is about this astonishing heroism of young Americans. Think of this. You know, look, next time you see an 18 or a 19-year-old kid or a black kid, whatever, that young, think of them being in Nashville, Tennessee, getting on a bus, making out a will to go to another city in their own country, native soil, and some of them, in case the state in which they were raised, John Lewis, and making out wills because they were going to act upon the most elemental thing imaginable, which was to try and help other black people to vote. And and the threat of death was so great. I think that's real heroism. And I think there is a lapse in so many of my colleagues in following up what those stories were about in a more complicated era where good and evil are not so easily or readily defined 30 or 40 years later.
You talk about the spirit throughout this quite wonderful book. It's called The Children. You talk about spiritual things over and over again. I have a sense that people want that again, but just don't know where to focus, don't
know
where
to find it.
Well,
I think the country's very uneasy. The country's infinitely more materialistic than it was when I was young. It's more successful. It's richer. The highs are higher. The ability, I mean, who would have thought that you could have people making $200 million a year? I mean, in the old days,
unbelievable,
you know,
when
I was a young person, the great fortunes were amassed over a long period of mm-hmm. time, you know, whether it was Vanderbilts or Fords or Rockefellers. Now, you know, you bet the right horse in technology or you're Michael Eisner and you jiggle the book in the stock and you're making $200 million a year. So, I mean, there's an enormous materialism in this country, and a lot of it is driven by television, which is always urging you to buy this, go here, fly there, use this, have one of these. And some of that's good and some of it is not so good. But I think in an odd way, people don't feel very happy with their lives. A lot of people who are making more money than their parents did, but they're not comfortable. They don't feel rooted in the communities they live in. They don't know their neighbors. They're in new, instant suburban subdivisions. They go to work with, you know, an hour away and don't know that many people they work with. They don't know, as you know, as they did in Thornton Wilder's town, they don't know their doctor. He doesn't know their parents. They don't know their minister. Many of them meet their minister only when someone in their family has died. They don't know the local pharmacist. So there is a sense of being uprooted. When they had this fundamentalist million young white men march about a year ago, whatever it was, someone asked me to comment, and I thought it was about people who didn't feel connected in their lives. We're not getting any sense of enrichment or validity out of what they were doing, even though they were adequately compensated mm-hmm. in salary and material things.
What you're characterizing sounds like, and it sounds like alienation, but not just alienation from work, but alienation from community.
I think expectations that are not in trigger, not in track with the fuller rewards. The speed of technology has made life go too fast. Too much stuff is happening. You've begun to believe that the answers in life lay in purchasing things, and they don't, and yet you don't feel really like you're rooted in a community. You don't feel a part of anything larger, and you're wondering why your life is so empty. I think there's a lot of that.
We're going to be back in just a moment with David Halberstam, and I want to pick up with that thought and blend it with your newest book, The Children. Bill Russell and I are with David Halberstam at the Commerce Club, and we're going to be right back. Do stay with us.